When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome back, or welcome to the second part of my conversation with brilliant Matthew Broderick. Okay, lights down, people taking their seats. Here he is. Here's Matthew.
Gentlemen of the Stage Door Johnny Company, we have the house for Act Two. Mr. Cake and Mr. Broderick to the stage, please. This is your Act Two beginners.
So then Fifi... Yes. Gets, you're still with Fifi.
Yes.
Fifi gets a script to give to you by an unknown guy called Harvey Fierstein.
Yes, that's right. Harvey Fierstein is doing Torch Song Trilogy. It's the first time he's going to glue all three plays together into one evening. I've never heard of Torch Song Trilogy, but some people did know that he'd done them in the East Village.
He was a downtown hero a little bit, right?
Right. But I was like, who is that?
But Fifi, do you mind me jumping in? Fifi must have been slightly dubious about that, because a gay play,
a
young man.
Yes, it was.
At the time, it seems extraordinary now, but it was a difficult thing to...
Yeah, it was. I read for it, and it was one of the times when I read for something and the guy I was reading with, I could tell, was enjoying me. Huh. You know, this was not that feeling of, oh God, when will he stop talking, or, right. You know... This was, I was reading with Harvey, who was just grinning, you know, so I felt this new, like, you know, the feeling, you just feel like somebody wants to hear me a little bit.
Also, by the way, what an act of courage for you to be able to even do that, walk in that room. You'd had all this encouragement and then this shattering stuff.
Yeah.
And I just think, I'm reminded again, this is completely in passing, but I'm reminded again of the daily heroism of... actors putting their self-esteem on the line again when it's potentially only going to get kicked around the room.
Oh, yeah.
I know it's not digging ditches. I know it's not dangerous spy missions, but it can feel shattering to your sense of self-worth.
Oh, absolutely. And it's easy to lose touch with that. I mean, you're putting yourself in that position, but... it's devastating, these things, you know.
Particularly to a young
silly
person.
As it sounds. Yeah, because I loved it, you know. He wanted it so bad.
Yeah.
And
So Harvey is giving you the answering gleam. He's enjoying you.
Yes, we're sitting opposite each other at a table. And he's just reading in his crazy voice. And I've never met any or heard anybody like him. But I also read the script and I was like, this is hilarious. Like, I knew when I read the part,
this is great, so good.
It was so funny. And he was chain smoking, probably as was I. But I just felt good around him.
Yeah.
You know? He was a Brooklyn guy.
Right.
I was a Manhattan guy. I just immediately, we liked the same jokes or something like that.
Right.
And I read with him a bunch of times. I think I may have read with Estelle Getty that day, too.
Gosh.
She started to give me something. And I said, let me just do the one reading and then... Then tell me. Look, let me do one where you don't tell me. See, that's how I was when I was young.
Oh, good for you.
Yeah.
And the
rest of the time we did the play, Estelle and I, we shared a dressing room, actually, eventually, when we did the play.
Did you really?
And she was like, and this one, I don't take notes. She was always making fun of me for saying that I didn't want her garbagey notes.
Where did that... self-confidence come from? Because she was a big noise at the time, right? Estelle Getty? No?
I didn't know her. She became one.
I see.
She was just an annoying, you know, lady trying to boss me around.
Right. So it was self-preservation as much as a sense of your own security.
And also, I wanted to just do one my own little right. self. And yeah, I don't know.
Do you think you've always had a very strong sense of how you want to do stuff?
A little bit. I think I might have had it more when I was younger, to tell you the right. truth.
Interesting.
And in some ways, it's better not to. Like, it's definitely good if you have a idea of your own, but it took me a while to figure out that it's no good pulling in separate directions. It is enough if it's just enough that you're having a little tension, but still coming up with a good thing. But to really say, I want it this way, you want it that way, and the director's going to edit it. And I'm much more attempt now to fit in with what's wanted. I'm much more curious what somebody wants.
Right.
When I used to be a little more like, hey, leave me alone. Let me just do it.
Right.
I think.
So Torch Song,
yeah.
Sorry if I'm jumping ahead, but Torch Song becomes this great big downtown hit. People can't get in.
That's right. It starts at the place called the Richard Allen Center on the fourth floor of a, or sixth floor of a building on 62nd Street. It's empty. It's over 4 hours long. We can't sell. The house is half full. I'm the assistant stage manager as well. I was cast in the role as David and the assistant stage manager. I had to run the slide projector for the act before me, and I was whined about that so much because it left me no time to hang out in my dressing room, which is all I want, you know. So I was like, I only have 5-10 minutes to get ready during intermission now. You guys can't make me run this fucking slide projector. And they're like, all right, okay, stop. Don't run the slide projector. Just switch the plugs. You have to switch all the lighting when it switches from act two to act three. This is pre-computers. You have to switch all these right. cables into their correct numbers. Now, as Sally Field had pointed out, this is not my strong suit, this kind of task. So I plugged everything wrong 2 or 3 times, and they were like, no more plugs for you.
You don't have any responsibilities anymore.
You're an actor, that's it. No more stage managing stuff.
My God, you're back to the rude mechanicals.
Yeah. So, and it was in this horrible theater, and I shouldn't say horrible, it was charming, but water leaked when it rained.
Wow.
As they say. And Harvey would move the houseplants under the water.
He would react to the dripping.
Yes, he would just move over
that's
the plant.
That's brilliant.
And
that's brilliant.
Then Mel Gusso from The Times came to see it, wrote this glowing review, and suddenly full. And suddenly friends are saying, hey, can you get me where I was saying, you want to come see this four and a half hour show about a drag queen that I'm in? And they'd be like, yeah, no. Now they're like, my uncle's coming into town. Is there any possible, it all changes.
Yeah.
And now I'm auditioning, and it's no longer that feeling of...
Right. This guy from the car crash.
Yeah, or nothing, yeah. This is the guy in that hot play.
Yeah.
He must be good,
Yeah.
Now everything changed.
And you're still only 19.
Yeah, I believe so.
And so you get a script. Did you get a whole script for Brighton Beach Memoirs?
I got
by Neil Simon?
First I read some scenes for the casting director.
Right.
Then when I had passed one or two auditions, I don't know, I was allowed to go read the script at Manny Eisenberg's office.
Yeah.
They said, we're not going to send it to anybody's home, but you're welcome to come. Read the new Neil Simon play.
The new Neil Simon play. It's hard for people to understand, but at that point, already he was a Broadway god.
Absolutely.
I mean, he was the resident American comic playwriting genius.
Yeah.
I suppose the only equivalent we'd have here would be the absolute heyday of Alan Ayckbourn.
Mm.
Similarly prolific.
Right.
And incredibly commercially successful, but also this whole other aspect of him, tell me if I'm wrong about Neil Simon, which was something completely put his finger on the sort of zeitgeist, the pulse of life at the time. You couldn't believe this person was producing one masterpiece after
and movies
another.
Too
movies
at the time,
so you go in and you read, and did you not end up auditioning on the stage for
Yes.
Neil Simon?
I auditioned, and then I went to, I think, Ain't Misbehavin' was playing somewhere, and I was in that bar of Ain't Misbehavin', the
set. Right.
Reading for I think I read twice for him in a theater. Once with him and then once with him and Herbert Ross, the director. And I met Neil Simon that day and he was sitting out in the house, you know.
Yeah.
And he walked up to the lip of the stage to just say hello and shake hands or something. He was very quiet person, you know, shy person. But he laughed. I heard him laugh a few times.
Did you?
Like, well, that must be, that can't be all bad. Oh, and,
can there be anything better?
I know. I saw his glass. I could see just like his glasses, you know, catching the light.
Glinting.
Yeah. But I'd hear a few like chuckles.
Oh.
And then he looked very warm when he said goodbye, you know. So I thought, oh, God.
And Brighton Beach, anybody who doesn't know it, is sort of autobiographical.
Yes, I was reading his life. I was supposed to be him, basically. Yeah.
So to make him.
Yeah. He was laughing at his own self.
Well, he'd earned it.
Yeah.
Okay, but you're also missing out another vital part of this audition story. He was also making a movie.
Yes.
At the same time. They were casting it at the same time called...
Right. Max Dugan Returns.
Max Dugan Returns. And they had you read for that at the same time. Yes?
Yes. This was the callback. I went to read for the director, for Herbert Ross. And I read my scenes from Brighton Beach. And they're like, thanks. Would you take a look at this screenplay that Herbert's about to direct, that Neil wrote? Will you read for that? And I said, now? And they were like, yeah. And I was like, I have an appointment, but can I come back? And they were like, yeah, why don't you come back at 2 or something like that? Or, you know, which was a lie. I think I would have said, oh, I'll cancel the appointment if they had caught me. But I wanted a little time to read it and catch up.
Yes.
You know?
You were pretty smart.
I was pretty smart. You know, I couldn't plug things in.
Right.
I was smart or I was scared. I was also sort of like,
right.
I just wanted to get, I was just, I, they could maybe push me back. I knew there were a lot of people reading.
Right.
So I was like, can I be later on? I don't know why I had the nerve to say that, but I did.
So you went down the street to a coffee shop and read the script. So you had more of a sense of it.
I cheated.
Good for you.
And I don't know that I read the whole thing. I read as much as I could. And it probably didn't help me at all, by the way. Right. But I came back and I sat with Herbert Ross, the great director, in the audience of the theater. We sat next to each other and read every scene I had in the movie. We just went from the beginning. We just read through all of it.
Wow.
Said, thank you. And then he said, now can you read some more from Brighton Beach? Jelko Ivanek is coming, who's playing Stanley, Eugene's brother.
Yeah.
So come, we want to see if you guys look right, like brothers, you know. Right. So I read with Jelko, and so I've been there with a break for half a day or so. I was leaving, and the casting director, Marilyn Zatmary, I believe is her name, said, well, you had a good day. And I said, why? Did I get that movie? Because I had a feeling like, I don't know. Because, well, she said, you had a good day, so I knew something must have happened. So I said, did I get the movie? And she said, you got both, but don't tell anybody. Don't tell anybody I told you, because, you know, I'm not the one who's supposed to tell you that.
Both.
Yeah. And you never, as you know, you don't usually hear that. You have to go home and wait for somebody to. And she said, you got both. And
wow.
I was like, okay. And then Jelko and I went to get some food. He was already cast, you know, and I said, she says I'm cast, so. You know, I think I'm in it with you. And we ate. And then I called my dad from the diner or wherever we were, told him what happened. And he was like, what? He was like, both, you got... And he was fucking out of it. He was jumping out of his shoes. And it wasn't until I heard that I sort of let myself be like, wow, you know. I was definitely like, wow, but I was kind of stunned, I guess. Mm. But then when I heard him, I was like...
Was it a quality in his voice that was so... That brought you round?
Yeah, I hadn't heard him that way, you know. Right. He just was so delighted by it.
Right.
He
knew
what a kind of unicorn
of success for a young actor that day was for you. It never happens.
Yeah, he was
the lead in a Broadway show by the great living American genius, and a lead in a movie.
Yeah, it makes me angry hearing. I mean, sorry. If I was a young actor, I'd be like, Jesus, what the fuck?
No, but
of all the people.
But what's so extraordinary about this story is you've been lying in bed for, you know, all that time, feeling depressed and smoking pot, trying not to smoke pot.
Yeah.
After that movie, which you thought was going to catapult you to an Academy Award, fell apart underneath you.
Yeah, it all happened very quickly.
Incredible.
It's not like a long story. You know, this is all in a year, which is weird.
Yeah. Forgive me. Was your dad sick at that point?
Yeah, that's the underbelly. The not fun part of this story is my father was dying. He got sick right when I did Torch Song.
Yeah.
So we heard how bad he was during previews before we opened. Mm. So just by opening night, I knew he was not probably going to even survive. So the call about Brighton Beach to him when he was so happy, he was scratchy voiced because he'd had throat surgery. Like it was, it's a very bittersweet, more bitter than sweet, memory for me. But
presumably his joy must have been tinged by that.
Yeah, absolutely. Of course. Yeah, because I particularly hadn't heard him like that in the way he was feeling.
And you left the run of Brighton Beach to do War Games, I think, right? You did shot Max Dugan, came back to do Brighton Beach. I may be getting this wrong. And then, but didn't your dad call?
Yes.
The soundstage?
Max Dugan was first. While I was shooting Max Dugan, I was auditioning for War Games and got that part. And then I was able to fit War Games in before Brighton Beach started. But my father was very concerned about Brighton Beach. That was the one that he was so excited about.
Yeah, of course.
So he was like, he called me on the set of War Games. I was at MGM in a big soundstage. And they were like, you know, this is before cell phones. They were like, if a call, your dad's on the phone. And he was very unwell, you know.
Huh.
But I got to the phone and he wanted to know how the table read of Brighton Beach, which had been the day before, you know, before rehearsal starts. We'd all had that thing where all the actors finally get together and read out loud. He wanted to know how it was.
Right.
And I said, yeah, it was good. Everybody was seemed good and was fun to hear it out loud and all that. And that's the last time that we spoke.
Was it really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So
how incredible that you wanted to find out.
Yeah, and my mom was like, he really wanted to find out. Like, he was, you know, I don't know if you'd believe that kind of thing, but he definitely wanted to get that news, you know.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah.
That's amazing. You won the Tony for Brighton Beach.
Mm-hmm.
Still, I think, the youngest actor.
They sound great. I'm sounding so great.
That's what this podcast is for. This is your birthday present right here. You won the Tony. I think still the youngest person to ever win the Tony for leading actor.
Yeah.
And it started this collaboration. Five plays you did with Neil Simon. Up till this one now that we're sitting in your dressing room for, Plaza Suite, with your extraordinary wife, Sarah Jessica Parker, playing the three parts each in these three one-act plays that comprise Plaza Suite. And I want to find out a little bit more about him and what that was like. I wrote some things down about what you... Actually, you know what? Before we do that, can I just... I always forget the important things. Just because we've been talking about so much about your dad, and I'm so... It's so lovely of you to tell me all that extraordinary story of him. His influence on you was obviously, and probably continues to be, huge. I know that you thought he was a terrific actor. I know he was a New Hampshire guy, right? Mm-hmm. He wasn't a metropolitan, urban, you know, sophisticate. So do you feel that influence of his acting in you? Do you feel that example in you in some way?
I hope so. I think I do. He was very much... I'm more the wisecracker parts than he was, you know. But he's the kind of actor that when they're at their best, it doesn't look like they're doing anything. Like, there's great actors who you could still, they're working, you know, but I love right. watching them, right. you know, but then there's those ones that are just like, how the fuck did he become a baseball player? He never played baseball, but it looks totally believable.
Yeah. When he's the special agent in Dog Day Afternoon, Sid Lumet's
right.
Dog Day Afternoon, you're like, well, he's the,
yeah,
they got some guy, they got some cop.
Yeah. Yeah. He was just had a ability to disappear in right. these things. Right. And, I certainly aspire to that. He was very funny, too. Yeah, well, so I think sometimes people think, because of some of the roles I played, that I'm some kind of New York metropolitan, you know, whatever. But I think there is a good section of Hampton Beach, New Hampshire. And, you know, my grandfather was a letter carrier.
Was he?
Yeah. And a very brave person in World War One and a lot of things.
Really?
But the opposite of the parts I play, you know.
Right. So do you ever feel your father's, or is it more unconscious than this? Do you ever feel your father's example reproaching you or keeping you in line or like a
so.
Certain aesthetic that means that
yeah,
you
I
don't,
think so. You don't show off in
right,
a way,
you don't
know?
Show off.
Except if you can, if sometimes, you know, it's
really
except good.
Except if you can get away with it.
Yeah. He said to me once,
you don't show off. You absolutely don't show off.
Well, yeah. I like try to not get caught, you know, I guess is the idea. And, cause he could be a pretty out there actor too. I don't know. It's difficult to put into words what I got from him. He could be absolutely real and he didn't like bullshit, whatever that means.
Yeah.
And, he was very, it comes from the play, you know, he didn't bend things to fit his ideas. He tried to
right.
grow out of the thing, I think. Also,
There they go.
He didn't have the big commercial. I mean, he did a TV show called Family that everybody knew and the Sidney Lumet, as you mentioned, but even though there were regional theater and a bunch in New York, it's like, O'Neill, Shakespeare, he did serious parts. Like, I saw him do everything. Like, he had quite a career of much more classic great parts than I ever have played.
Right.
So I'm aware of that, too.
Do you remember, I'm going backwards from now, from Neil Simon, who we'll get to.
Mm.
Do you remember when we did a play together at the Roundabout Theatre, for the Roundabout Theatre? Christopher Hampton's The Philanthropist.
Yes.
You were that philanthropist.
Right.
And I had a big sort of porn star moustache and a purple suit.
Purple velvet suit.
This moustache, which was all my own, haunts the photos of my newborn daughter.
Oh, really?
You did, yes.
Yeah.
So all the pictures where I'm cradling my daughter, who was born during the run of that play, it looks like she's being handled by some terrible biker. I've got a quote about directors. It says, indeed, he drives directors mad his apparent insouciance.
Oh,
this is from a New York Times article by one of the thousands that have been written about you that I've been reading in the last 2 weeks.
Well, yeah.
Indeed, he drives directors mad with his apparent insouciance. I think, actually, the director of this current play, John Benjamin Hickey, our mutual friend, no. But he did say when you were doing, that Neil Simon was being inducted into the into the Library of Congress,
mm-hmm.
he did say something along the lines of, you know, he drove me batty in rehearsals because he didn't seem to be doing anything.
Yeah.
It's the same sort of interesting theme. So in this article, it says, the other actors, this is you, the other actors would already have very finished-looking performances and I'd still be holding the script and quiet. The director is in near hysterics occasionally. This is still you talking. I can't see what we have. This is you being the director. Because you're not doing anything. Is that a thing that you've always done?
Yes, I can't help it. It's not on purpose, but I've had a bunch of times where a director has come to me almost in tears saying, I can't see what we have. You've got to show me something.
And
the writers are killing them. The two writers have already killed themselves. we don't know what we have.
And why won't you?
My answer is always, I'm doing it. I feel I am doing it. I think I kind of am doing it, actually. It's just that when the audience comes, they laugh, and then then they're like, "Oh yeah, I always knew it was good." I don't know why I do that. I'm sorry. I apologize to those people who have been hurt by it, but I know what I'm doing. So, right. I mean, sometimes I don't, you know, or I don't figure it out. But I'm always trying. I've never been one to like be real showy in rehearsal. Uh-huh. I feel a little embarrassed or something.
We're back to your dad.
That might be my dad's something. He probably scared me out of it or something. But I do find with some directors, they're like, "Oh no, I see you." There's even somebody told me this. There's some performers who are known for that. That and there's a phrase like, you know, when the champagne is opened, he starts singing. You know that there's some people who they don't really perform until the light goes on or something like that. You know, and you just have to trust that they will. Yeah.
Is it possible it comes from movies a little bit too?
Could be.
That you know, essentially the first preview is the first take and why give it all away in the rehearsal room?
Yeah, I think so. Movies are interesting too because they're often better if you don't ever go beyond that. You can look like you're doing nothing to everybody in the movie, and I've even had that where people are like, "You're not, it's not coming across, whatever you think, it's nothing, you're doing nothing." And,
who told you that?
I don't know. Producers, you know, studio executive. We've seen the dailies, and I've got to tell you, it's not coming across it's not going through the lens, whatever. But then you go to a preview, and they're like, "Oh, you're so funny. I don't know what it is about you. It's magic, you know."
Wow.
Or not.
So essentially, you just learn to trust yourself that you'll get there somehow. But you do also want a director to be, you know, to give you stuff.
Absolutely. And I don't, it's not like I so trust myself that it's, I'm usually as insecure as anybody. So
I can attest to that.
Yeah. So the people saying you're not giving us what we need. It's not like I say, screw you. I know what's best.
Right.
It's like, oh fuck, I want to give you what you need. What do you mean? What should I be doing like this? Is this more like what you need? And they say, nope, it's still flat as a pancake. And,
I don't know what the answer is, but you are extraordinary on stage. And I think there is something about that Ken Howard thing that nobody ever made it look easier. And that there is an odd, I think, overlap between that and sort of something that people feel like they can't grab. And in the terrible paranoia and fear that surrounds a project before it comes to fruition.
Right.
Everyone needs to have proof upon proof upon proof that it exists.
Yes.
And of course, that isn't the way creativity works. It just arrives.
I know. And then occasionally it doesn't, you know.
Sometimes occasionally it doesn't. I wonder if it's something to do with your mum being a painter, too.
I don't know.
You wouldn't paint the picture before you finish painting the picture.
I mean, that's a good way to look at it. I don't know. It's something in my personality. I don't know. Nathan Lane said I'm like the Warner Brothers frog who does, you know, sings a whole aria and then... It's like a performing frog that this clown finds who can sing.
Right.
And it's like, I got to get you to my agent, you know. You're going to be the biggest star. You're the greatest. There's never been a frog that could sing a whole song. You know, puts him in the box, gets him to the big Ziegfeld's office. Where do you see this frog, Mr. Ziegfeld? You're going to build a whole new theater when you see this. And he lifts up the case and the frog goes, "Ribbit."
Yeah, you are you're a Warner Brothers frog in every possible way. Listen, so it was good enough for Neil Simon 5 times. I mean, he didn't know much about this last one. But you said of him, I'm sorry to sound like I'm just sort of quoting back all these times when you and great directors or writers had differences of opinion, but bear with me. You wrote of him, I think this was the induction into the Library of Congress, you wrote, he could also be blistering. I also got letters. He used to write you letters. I think I'm sure you still have them saying...
I don't, but I remember them.
Didn't he write the one wonderful one about Brighton Beach? He said, "I never knew I was so cute,
something like that." Yeah.
I mean, come on. You wrote he could also be blistering. I also got letters when he didn't love me. I'm not the only one who got letters occasionally that said, don't ruin my play.
Yeah.
But as soon as he expressed that, he'd forget it instantly. He never, ever held on to any temper. He would have it and then it was gone. And I thought, you know, because of course you had this great association with Mel Brooks. You know, these are the funniest people in American 20th century life. The funniest.
Yeah.
Did you ever feel a terrible pressure around being funny for them?
Yeah. I'm not good at that kind of pressure. Like, I'm stand-up comedians can just go out to a hostile audience and whip them into shape, you know?
Yeah.
They're incredible. But I'm like, if people aren't, if I don't feel this is the joke is going over and that everybody's wanting me to get to the punchline, I stutter and stammer and, you know, it's hard. I'm not great at it.
Because it can be a bare-knuckle sport. Anytime I've done comedy, it becomes also kind of a joyless process.
Oh,
was it ever like that with Neil Simon? The laboratory of laughs?
Sometimes, but I think Neil always liked best if it took off on its own, you know, if not talking about it. He just liked when he was laughing, you know?
Hmm.
So most of the time, he would be just delighted and not... It works best when you're not even talking about it too much, you know? Hmm. Once you get into that, which you ultimately do, that mechanical, take the pause out of the beginning of this sentence and take one breath here and you'll get the laugh back. It becomes very scientific. And as long as everybody's doing that in a... And it can work. Gene Sachs, right, who directed the Neil Simon plays that I did, the early ones, was very, very good at that.
Was he?
Yeah. He was also very good at anchoring everything in character. He didn't like any kind of joke that wasn't coming out of the story or that person, you know?
Right.
But once he did that, he was as good as anybody I've worked with at saying, try running those two sentences together. I think you might get a better reaction when you get to the last one.
And would Neil chip in too, or would you always go through Gene?
Always through Gene.
Okay.
Very formal that way. Then he would give his notes to actors, actually, at the end of Gene's notes. But they were more about language things, if you were changing something or how he meant something. Not only. He would give sort of a critique. You know, I liked when you were happier when you saw your mom. I liked when you were this. And mostly during rehearsal, you would try something, and if it wasn't great, you would see Neil's head whip to the side and whisper animatedly.
Oh, God.
Gene Sachs's ear would go nod, and then he'd say,
Matthew, can you go back to the way it was before you?
Yeah, okay.
That must have been the absolute opposite of seeing his glasses glint and hearing him chuckle.
No, it was quite frightening when he was scared that you were messing up his thing. Yeah. And the letters, the blistering Neil Simon was real. Like it was.
Right.
Yeah. He could be terrifying, but also incredibly loving.
Like a lot of great American titans of the theater, Tennessee Williams, Arthur Miller, he became a sort of prophet without honor by the end of his life. Have I got that right? Because, of course,
I
wasn't.
That's right.
You found it harder and harder. There's a heartbreaking thing that you said. This was from another Times article. It says, in recent decades, Simon's brand of broad situation comedy has fallen out of favor. Its situation's increasingly unrelatable. I'm not sure I agree with that, but anyway. A 2009 Broadway revival of Brighton Beach Memoirs closed after 1 week.
Yeah.
And it says that you, Broderick, last encountered Simon at that low point. When the actor, when you walked into Orso and saw Neil Simon sitting right there at the table that you did the interview with this guy at. What was that like?
I think Brighton Beach was just opening, so they didn't know yet.
Okay.
He was like, we need a Stanley. You want to play Stanley? And I was like, Neil, I'm 20 years too old for Stanley. That's the older brother.
Right.
And
is that Jill Kerr's part?
Yeah.
Right.
I think that's what he said. Yeah, I didn't see him. I did a reading of Rumors, a farce that he had written. It was the last time I think I saw him. And he was a little out of it mentally. And even the rehearsals of Odd Couple, which I did, he was not his old self, you know. He sat there, but he didn't speak much.
And, right.
Yeah, I think what you said, he's... Toward the end of his life, he would do readings of plays and everybody would say, well, let's not do that one. Or he started to do one that was off Broadway. Like suddenly he wasn't quite he had gone from having, I think at one point, 3 or 5 Broadway shows at once. And Terrence McNally said, the playwright, about Neil, he said once, nobody knows how to write a play. So don't listen to anybody who says this is how you write. Nobody knows how to write a successful play. Except for a while, we thought Neil Simon did. But this nobody knows except one person knew for a little while.
It does feel like there's something inbuilt into American theater, more so than here, because of the distance between success and failure. Because it's the commercial theater as opposed to subsidized theater largely here. It's a hit or it's a miss. And generally it exists on the say-so of one person, the critic of the Times. Mm. I mean, you have lived an entire life, so we've just been talking about it, since you were a young teenager, in that bear pit of success or failure.
Yeah.
But it does feel like there's something endemic to that system, which means that these great geniuses of the theatre can only ever fall, because it's impossible to sustain that level of...
Yeah.
That level of excellence.
And even, like, now I hoped, and I don't think we're there yet, that, you know, like, I don't really read reviews, but he still doesn't really get that much respect, you know?
Right.
And I'm not even sure that I've always assumed that he will, ultimately, and I still think that, but they're not treated with seriousness and respect by critics sometimes as much as I thought it's long enough now, you might start to think of him as a writer, not just that commercial guy who you're mad at for some unknown reason.
Right. It feels very moving to me for all sorts of different reasons, but that given your lifelong association with him, that you're here now in this dressing room, you're going to do it again tonight sooner than you probably care to.
Oh, boy.
You're still holding him up to the light.
Yeah.
All these years later.
I love him, you know, it's a pleasure. And I'm sure people will continue. I know they, because, you know, also audiences still like it.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh my God, are you kidding me? The reason we're hearing all those empties, by the way, is probably from last night's show of yours.
From last night, yeah,
people who were getting schnockered on champagne.
No, people still laugh.
It's an incredible party, this show. People love it.
I know, and... somebody will do it again, and there's a bunch of others that people ought to do, you know, and I don't know.
I was going to ask you about failure, because I'm haunted. We can do this very quickly and possibly.
You heard yourself. You heard how great I am.
Well,
what do you mean failure?
That's absolutely right. I think we've definitely attested to that long and loud. That's indisputable. I know, I suppose I'm going back to this point about you living in this crazy fucking bear pit of massive success or disaster, which is so enshrined in that idea of the opening night party on Broadway, which is, to an extent, is a cliche, but it's kind of true. You put the champagne out and take it all away if the review comes in badly. And I'm haunted by this memory of you and I back in Bar Central, sitting in a booth, in my memory, with Nathan Lane, Mike Nichols, and Kenny Lonergan.
Oh, Jesus.
And somebody got the review up for our play on the phone.
Yeah.
And in a terrible moment that I wanted to murder them for, handed it to you, because I think you said, let me see it or something.
Yeah.
And someone didn't say, no, my phone is glitching. I can't get a signal. You read it, and it was not a bad review. It just wasn't a great review. It was a perfectly respectable, you know, bits about this work, bits about this don't. And suddenly there was this funereal silence at the table with these New York gods, you know.
Yeah.
And I, being an idiot, I suppose probably also not being from there, not really being native to that culture, was like, wait, hang on, are you fucking kidding me? You're Matthew Broderick, 2-time Tony Award. This is just going. We'll have fun doing this for however long we're doing this 8-week engagement. You're going to be on to the next thing. It cannot be given the weight that suddenly everybody's giving it. And I also knew at the same time, I was completely wrong.
Well, yeah. I feel like, I don't know that I read it, that I feel like somebody probably just
summed it up to me.
Maybe I did. You don't usually have the nerve. Yeah, it doesn't make any sense. I mean, you have to keep in mind that, like, you've been doing it a long time and you're still you and whatever, but.
Didn't seem like that night.
I know. I tried to keep that in mind, but don't you feel like you put everything into it and then somebody publicly says you stink?
But you've been riding this crazy wave up and down your whole life. You've been getting the shit kicked out of you, and then you've been called the second coming over and over and over again. It must do something to your nervous system.
That's bad. Yeah, I gotta get out of it. I remember some years ago, though, a producer was like, "You never get bad reviews on stage. Sometimes your movies, but have you ever gotten bad reviews on stage?" I was like, "I'm not sure that I have." I said, "From that date on, I'm not sure I've gotten a good review."
That's not true.
No, there have been a few, but there have been a lot of bad ones. And I'm not used to it. As you said, it's one guy at the times. And sometimes you're like, wait a minute, this one guy, and he doesn't like me. And
it's hard to change.
I'm going
to
be
idea.
With him for the next 20. What's going to happen here?
Exactly? It's him or me.
Yeah. But then you never know what's every now and then the one who doesn't like you likes you.
Yeah.
I don't know. I read a book about Buster Keaton recently, and he said, paraphrasing, because they said he didn't care that much about reviews. And he said, one fellow likes me, the other one doesn't, so what? It's just the fellow who likes you or doesn't.
Yeah, of course.
I know that's simple, but I never quite think of it that way. And I think he really did feel so what. Though he went from superstar to washed up, nobody thought he was good at all, and that I can't think he was as cool about it as that quote sounds.
But look at his reputation now. You know, he was beloved by everybody from Samuel Beckett to Jean Le Goff.
And he did luckily live long enough to start to hear that.
Yeah. So there's hope
for
you.
Already sickly, but
Well, you don't have time to talk about this now, but one of my greatest joys in New York theatre was watching you in Kenneth Lonergan's play Starry Messenger, which you did here in London.
Mm.
And that was another one that Kenny was directing for the first time.
Yes.
Rumors of it being an absolute disaster abounded. And Ben Brantley, the critic of the Times, came along and said, if this is a disaster, show me the apocalypse or something. I can't remember what it was.
That's right.
But it was basically, you know, you were fantastic in that play.
And that's one I thought, oh, he never likes him, but he did like that
play.
So, what do you know?
Okay, last thing. Positively last thing. You did, you've done so many. This is one of the things I really, really admire about you. You've taken so many extraordinary little left and right turns, these little tributaries of interest that have fascinated. You've done the producers, which it's hard to overstate for anybody who wasn't around at the time.
Mm.
What a global phenomenon it is. The success that was going on in New York around that show makes Hamilton look like, you know, an out-of-town summer stop, you know, revival.
Know.
It's true.
Yeah,
it was a riot breaking out. It was incredible. You've done that. You've done these extraordinary things that have been must-sees, and yet you've always taken these little backroads to very, very interesting things. There was a thing you did with Elaine May, taller than a dwarf. You couldn't, you wouldn't name it that now. directed by Alan Arkin.
Yeah.
Incredible. Yeah. I want to find out more about that, but we don't have time.
Yeah.
And you did these things at the Irish Rep with Conor McPherson and obviously with Kenny. Sylvia, the great Edward Albee play, you fall in love with a goat. Mm. And one of the things that I loved reading about was a Wally Shawn play called Evening at the Talkhouse.
Yes.
Which feels to me, I think you did it in 2017, just after Trump's election.
Is that correct? Yeah.
And anybody who doesn't know that play, it sort of depicts this kind of bourgeois dinner party, which seems to be being lived out, it gradually emerges, under a kind of Nazi occupation.
Mm.
Which is such an extraordinary idea.
I love that.
And in that world, it imagines a world where there's no theatre. I think the idea is that essentially there's entertainment.
Yeah.
But the theatre has been phased out. So I suppose my last question is this. When President Trump gets back in later this year, changes the constitution to allow unlimited terms, and theatre is gradually... Theatre will be gradually banned.
Yeah.
Are you and Robert De Niro, two famous New Yorkers, going to get together and, you know...
And do what? What
are we going to do? Well, Robert De Niro always wants to fight Donald Trump.
Yes. Instead of, you know, that's maybe they'll hold him down.
While
Robert De Niro beats him up.
You hold Robert De Niro's coat.
I don't want a visit from the Secret Service. I don't know. What's the question?
There is none. There is no question. I suppose it's just this idea of theater is a danger to people who want, in whose interest it is to restrict human interaction and an examination of what it is to be a human being.
Yes, and that's terrifying.
Yeah.
People who want.
And I think that's really true, because I think it's impossible to go to the theater, even though it's expensive and even though it doesn't represent every strata of society in the way that we wish it did. Mm. And even though it can feel like a kind of niche privilege, it still does do something that reminds us of something very fundamental and important about sharing ideas and representations of what it is to be a human being, isn't it?
Absolutely. I think it's easy as an actor, to bitter old actor like we are, to, you know, you're not as old as me, but
almost,
to say, oh, this doesn't matter, this is bullshit, just learning lines and saying them, and this is stupid and all that. I think the pandemic also helped remind me, like, the gap of everything you said, too. I mean, that all these ideas that need to be shared in this way, but also just the community of getting together and experiencing these things together was so missed, at least by me, and I think by a lot of people. It really reminded me how essential to my life, not just being in plays, but watching them, talking about them, having friends who saw the same thing, and examining our lives it's everything. So, and then these little theaters that are going out of business now all over the country and that are just doing revivals or just doing 3 revivals instead of 8 plays that I keep reading about is terrifying. It's like when people say, let's hang the journalist from a tree, you know. I mean, it's the same thing. This is terrifying.
And maybe the threat is not coming so much from Trump as it is coming from just this gradual digitalization of our everyday lives. The idea of meeting in a crowd of strangers, sitting in the dark to receive people moving in space in front of us, telling us a story from beginning to end, feels really antithetical to how we mostly want to live now.
I know.
Ease and convenience and not going out.
I'm surprised people put up with it anymore, but they do so far.
And I would argue that we should.
Oh, absolutely we should. And I'm amazed that they do. People seem to still love it when they do it. But I would think they'd just be like, the hell is this? There's nothing lighting up. Or I can watch a movie. Why would I watch this?
Right.
But they do.
And I can talk and spill
drink
all over myself.
Then they do. You heard the bottles.
Thank you so much for giving me this time. Was it cheering for you on the day after your birthday to be reminded of your...
How great I am.
Yeah.
Yes. Thank you.
In that case.
Thank you.
If this podcast exists for anything, it should exist for that.
No, I feel a little embarrassed. You know what? You should have another person in soon to say about things that I did that weren't so good.
Okay.
Just to even things out.
Get some of those directors who are like,
there's plenty of them. But thank you very much. You're overly complimentary. Thank you.
Don't be ridiculous. Yeah. Thank you.
All right.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There he goes, out of the stage door, to go and get a little sustenance before he has to do Plaza Suite again. Ah, thank you, Matthew. Happy birthday. Thank you for giving me that time and just having a little walk through your extraordinary life. I'm really so grateful to you for doing that for me. Thank you so much to all of you for listening. I hope you've enjoyed this season. I can't wait to do more of them. I hope you are looking forward to some more chats too. It's wonderful to still be able to think deeply and engage deeply with some of the greatest artists of this form, the theatre. It's such a joy to me to investigate them all. Thank you so much to Ben Backhouse. He's my producer and he puts this all together. Does a wonderful job. Thank you to the musicians, Iggy and Phoebe Cake. Thank you to the stage manager. And I really look forward to being back with you, I think, very soon. I think. But as I said at the start, life is unpredictable. All right. Cherish the theatre while we still have it. If Wallace Shawn's sort of Cassandra-ish predictions are anything to go by, it's not a given that it always exists, just like all our other freedoms and all the other ways in which we make sense of our lives in something approaching a democracy. It's not a given for sure. Take care. Bye.
Stage door Johnny. Stage door Johnny. Not a line rhymes with Johnny, but here it is. Stage door Johnny. Stage door Johnny. He sits in the balcony, sees plays sad and funny. That's stage door Johnny. Stage door Johnny. He knows that there's no money. Being stage door Johnny. Stage door Johnny.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.